طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. Again this morning, we continue our coverage of the Balfour Legacy Conference, held in Cambridge, Massachusetts on November 11th of 2017. Today featuring an extraordinary panel on intersectionality, the relationship of all human rights struggles with each other, and the power of that recognition. The first to speak on the panel is Matoi Monroe, a co-leader of the American Indians of New England. She is also lead organizer for the Indigenous Peoples Day, which works to get communities to recognize Indigenous Peoples Day in lieu of Columbus Day, as was done by Cambridge in 2016. Matoi is followed by Gabriel Camacho, whose parents emigrated from Mexico in the 1990s. Gabe has served on the boards of a myriad of Latino organizations and currently is the Immigration Program Coordinator for the American Friends Service Committee. The next panelist to speak is Carl Williams, currently a staff attorney with the ACLU of Massachusetts and former defense attorney for the Roxbury Defenders. He is active with the National Lawyers Guild and is a lecturer at the Northeastern Law School. The final speaker is Nadia Ben-Youssef, a lawyer and human rights activist and the first U.S. representative for ADLA, the legal center for Arab minority rights located in Haifa, Israel. She is now developing ADLA's U.S. advocacy strategy to shape American discourse and influence U.S. policy and practice in Palestine, Israel. Here is the intersectionality panel of the Balfour Legacy Conference.
My name is Matoi, and I'm co-leader of United American Indians of New England, and I'm also a lead organizer for Indigenous Peoples Day campaigns here in the state, including in Cambridge, where we won Indigenous Peoples Day in June of 2016. I always say to people that one of the reasons that we do Indigenous Peoples Day is because non-Native people don't listen to us and act as though that we're not here. And we are literally trying to save the earth. And if you can't listen to us, we're not going to be able to do that. So Indigenous Peoples Day is an important first step in bringing Native voices more to the center where they should be. I want to acknowledge before I begin today that we are on stolen Indigenous land, the land of the Massachusetts people. This land was never ceded. There is no treaty. They were simply pushed off the land. The river was given an English name. The city was given an English name. When I think about al-Nakba and Palestine, it was preceded not only by the Balfour Declaration, but also the British Mandate, Napoleon, the Crusades, the Catholic Church's doctrine of discovery, and many other doctrines. All of these combined represent an entire settler worldview with roots not only in theology, but going further back to the very origins of private property and patriarchy and the rise of the state. First, they justified it with theology, and later, they justified it as the white man's burden. And now, as the U.S. does, in the name of supposedly protecting human rights. Under various theological and legal doctrines formulated during and after the Crusades, non-Christians were considered enemies of the Catholic faith and, as such, less than human. The Dum Diversus Bull of 1452 and other related bulls, those are like edicts issued by popes, granted the Pope's blessing to capture, vanquish, and subdue the Saracens, pagans, and other enemies of Christ, and put them into perpetual slavery, and to take all their possessions and their property. The Intercetera Bull of 1493 granted authority to Spain and Portugal to take all lands and possessions, so long as no other Christian ruler had previously claimed them. These bulls instilled the doctrine of discovery, the papal sanctioning of Christian enslavement and power over non-Christians. Indigenous peoples in the Americas have our own Nakba. That was the invasions of Columbus, Cortez, Cabot, and all the others. When Columbus sailed west across the so-called Sea of Darkness, with the express understanding that he was authorized to take possession of any lands he discovered that were not under the dominion of any Christian rulers, he and the Spanish sovereigns of Aragon and Castile were following an already well-established tradition of discovery and conquest that was very much focused on Palestine. Acts of genocide and conquest committed by Columbus and his men and all the other invaders against the peaceful native people of the Caribbean were sanctioned. The papal documents were frequently used by invaders in the Americas to justify an incredibly brutal system of colonization, which referred to the territories as being inhabited only by brute animals. With all of this history behind them, of course the British and League of Nations felt free to carve up and distribute Palestine. Zionists spoke about Palestine as a land without people for a people without a land. And even if the land was inconveniently not entirely empty, it was somehow full of people who had no real connections to the place. They didn't know how to develop and exploit the land the way the Europeans did, the Zionists said. They didn't know how to make the desert bloom, and so they lacked legitimacy on the land. The indigenous people everywhere lose legitimacy because we are somehow not sufficiently there, yet too much there. And then we lose legitimacy because we are made up of nomads who don't really care about the place the way the settled Europeans do. And so Palestinians were pushed onto reservations, really. Refugee camps, Gaza, these are all reservations. Now here, the pilgrims in Plymouth and the Puritans here in Boston and Cambridge, here in this very parish actually, we always bring history home to where we are, they were obsessed with the idea that they were in a wilderness, as though the land were empty and waiting for them. This idea is so embedded that even today, I hear from school children and adults alike that the Europeans brought civilization here, that indigenous peoples were not actually doing anything with the land. I speak about this to make clear that the U.S. and Israel are both settler nations. Sometimes I have noticed that people here can point to Israel as a settler state, but cannot see that is the case right here. If you claim to support the struggle of Palestinians, then you must also be supporting indigenous struggles right here. Sometimes settlers talk about working toward reconciliation, and that's been the case in Canada, but reconciliation still means you're taking our land and putting pipelines through it and destroying our water, doesn't it? So reconciliation is nice, and apologies are nice, but that is not nearly enough. What we need is decolonization. When we are talking about decolonization, let's review who is here. Here in the United States, we have indigenous peoples here, many of them now coming from Mexico, El Salvador, and other settler countries, but they're indigenous. We didn't have those borders. We have settlers. They and their progeny stole land and eradicated millions of native peoples in every single inch of stolen state of the United States. Settlers became their own law. They became their own government. They supplanted indigenous laws and beliefs with their own values. We also have millions of stolen peoples, black people whose ancestors were largely brought here as slaves. I've heard sometimes people say that if you're not indigenous, you're a settler. That's not true. Stolen peoples can't at all be called settlers. We also have newcomers who came here after the dirty work of the slaughter and displacement of indigenous peoples, but who often adopt the worldview of settlers. These newcomers benefit from settler colonialism, whether or not they intend to, by dint of living on stolen indigenous land. Every aspect of what we do and think needs to be decolonized, treating the earth and life like a commodity, consuming resources endlessly. This is also at the foundation of settler colonialism. I read a good definition of decolonization. It is the intelligent, calculated, and active resistance to the forces of colonialism that perpetuates the subjugation and/or exploitation of our minds, bodies, and lands. Decolonization is engaged for the ultimate purpose of overturning the colonial structure and realizing indigenous liberation. Well, I would actually say that decolonization is for the liberation of all of us, because all of us are poisoned by settler colonialism. Every aspect of our lives and thought have been impacted. Ultimately, decolonization should lead to the return of control of the land to indigenous peoples. This does not necessarily mean that everybody needs to leave, but it does mean that indigenous people have the right to decide what happens, and that should put a stop to things like pipelines and fracking pretty fast. I know this idea of decolonization and return of lands and control of indigenous peoples is uncomfortable for settlers to admit to and to talk about, but this fear of who has a right to claim and control the land is very much the basis of settler hatred for indigenous peoples. Finally, as an indigenous human being, I have the utmost feelings of solidarity with the Palestinian people because they are our relatives. Palestinian people must have the right to decide what the fate of their country should be. Their right to self-determination must be respected first and foremost. I believe that all of us must support and learn from Palestinians on their own terms and support their resistance without providing a settler colonial overlay of what we think are acceptable forms of resistance. Thank you.
What we're going to do is, thank you for the framing. That was excellent. And what I'm going to do is focus on a comparison between territorial loss in Mexico and what's going on in Palestine now. So, and the reason why I've been going around doing this presentation is because organizations, Zionist organizations, such as the ADL, the JCRC, are actually inviting leaders of the immigrant community, of the Latino immigrant community, in all expenses paid trips to Israel to show them how good they treat their immigrants, meaning Jews from Europe and North America. So, okay. So, so without further ado, we're going to go on. I was asked to abbreviate this presentation. But basically, I mean, we all know that, you know, Palestine and Mexico are continents apart, different historical and cultural development. However, let's do a very brief comparison. So in Mexico, the Spaniards invaded the New World in the early 1500s, followed by other European empires. In Palestine, after various Eurasian empires ruled the Middle East, Palestine is ruled by the Ottoman Empire. In Mexico, Mexico becomes a possession of the Spanish crown. Palestine becomes a mandate of the British Empire after World War I. In Mexico, in 1821, Mexico gains independence from Spain and outlaws slavery. It's one of the first laws it passes as an independent country. In the 1830s, U.S. Slave state expansionists begin to settle in the Mexican state of Texas, or what you call Texas, and campaigns of ethnic cleansing ensue. In the late 1800s, the European Zionist movement plans to colonize Palestine. Zionist violence terrorized Christian and Muslim Palestinians in the early 1900s, and campaigns of ethnic cleansing ensue. This is the basic pattern of settler colonialism. In Mexico, the new state of the lone state of Texas declares itself independent from Mexico and is later annexed by the United States. Provoked by U.S. settler aggression, Mexico declares war on the U.S. in 1846. U.S. invades Mexico, and this is very interesting. Irish nationals in the U.S. infantry defect to the Mexican army. Good. So have you heard of this story, the San Patricios? Oh, yeah. Very interesting. Irish Americans won't talk about this, but in Ireland, they will talk about it. In Palestine, in 1947, the UN partition plan is approved with the support of Western powers, but rejected by Arab nations, as we heard before in the various panels. Under the UN partition plan, 55% of historic Palestine is apportioned to, quote, a Jewish state, and Arab states reject the plan. The Treaty of Guadalupe and Hidalgo and al-Nakba. Treaty of Guadalupe and Hidalgo is what we consider our Nakba. In 1848, interesting, 100 years before, 1848, Mexico loses 50% of its national territory to the United States. The newly acquired territories include the states of Texas, Colorado, Nevada, Arizona, Nuevo Mexico, California, Utah, and Wyoming. Nakba, 1948, Palestine loses, as you know, 48% of its land to the Jewish state. Over 750,000 Palestinians are dispossessed from their homes and their lands. Thousands become refugees in their own land or flee to other neighboring countries. And this is very interesting because AFSC does have a lot of history in this area. AFSC is asked by the UN to provide humanitarian relief in the Gaza Strip shortly after the Nakba. Well, this is what Mexico used to look like. In the entire Southwest and West. That's what Palestine used to look like. And this here is, and this is the partition plan, as we heard before. We don't need to explain it here. And then afterwards, Texas is annexed to the newly acquired United States. So basically, what's east of the Mississippi starts becoming part of the United States. This is after the war, and basically what's left for Palestinians is the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. And then this is Mexico today, as you know. There's a lot of violence along the border, in particular because of the walls and all the security apparatus that the United States is investing, including the State of Israel, as we heard before. So we also looked at manifest destiny and Zionism, because you need an ideology to justify the taking over a territory and also to dehumanize the other person. So manifest destiny is expansionist. Zionism is expansionist. Manifest destiny has the racist notion of civilizing the West. Remember, it was Native Americans and Mexicans that lived in that area, therefore savages. So Zionism is the racist notion of a land without a people for a people without a land, although early Zionists acknowledged that there were many Palestinians living in those lands. Manifest destiny presumes racial superiority of white people over indigenous and Mexican people. Zionism presumes racial superiority of Jews over Palestinians and other Arabs. And this, therefore, justifies ethnic cleansing in both both historical examples. Two walls. So basically, in the United States, in 2006, the U.S. Congress passed the Secure Fence Act, which would expand the wall between Mexico and the United States by 700 miles. And just a footnote, I made this presentation back in 2008. Colesman Inc. of New Hampshire, a wholly owned subsidiary of Elbit Systems of Haifa, Israel, builds the high-tech portions of that wall, meaning the motion sensors, the infrared cameras, and all that stuff. Billions of dollars. In the West Bank, in 2005, the Israeli Knesset approves the plan to build an apartheid wall well within the West Bank. Elbit Systems, the largest private military contractor in Israel, builds the apartheid wall inside the West Bank. So here we have a direct connection between what's going on in the U.S.-Mexico border and what's going on in the West Bank. This is a rather old map before the wall was complete. I won't go over it now because of time. But basically, I organized a delegation of color to go to Palestine in 2008. And we had Asian Americans, Latin Americans, Native Americans, African Americans go to Palestine and to view Palestine from our particular perspective of racial discrimination in the United States, our history of national liberation throughout the world, and indeed our fight for civil rights and autonomy here in the United States. So what we learned with talking to our Palestinian brothers and sisters was that the apartheid idea of cantons and Bantustans are being applied to the West Bank, ever-shrinking areas where Palestinians can live and work. We discuss Israeli political, economic, and military relations with apartheid South Africa and the right-wing military dictatorships of Central America during the 1980s. We discuss the impunity police have in killing people of color, incarceration rates, and military-style ICE raids. This was before Ferguson. We learned the idea of transfer, the forceful removal of Palestinians from their land to other Arab nations, is a common political discourse amongst Israeli Jews. And we also talk about gentrification. We learned about the idea of security and terrorism justifies checkpoints, arbitrary arrests, detentions, and border militarization. So basically, we learned that together we have one struggle. I think I'm out of time. So this is just a picture. You know, can you tell that's Palestine? Can you tell that's Mexico? Not really. The fence, same company builds it. One interesting thing, we saw the image of Che Guevara all over the refugee camps. And, you know, that made me feel very warm and comfortable. So again, you know, this is basically a presentation to start a conversation on how we can build an intersectional movement between Latin Americans here in the United States and in Mexico, as well as our brothers and sisters in Palestine. Thank you.
My name is Carl Williams. I do by day. I work for the American Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts, and a lot of the rest of my time, I do legal movement work with the National Lawyers Guild of Massachusetts. That's me. Specifically today, I wanted to talk about a declaration, because we're talking about declarations today, right? So, 241 years ago, a declaration was drafted, right, by some British folks, right? And it was a colonizing declaration, right? It was an explicitly racist declaration. And actually, I closed my phone, but now I need to open it and get back to the quote from that to connect to what my sister Matoi said. Just quoting from that declaration, it says, he, speaking about the King of England, he has excited domestic insurrections amongst us, and he has endeavored to bring upon the inhabitants of our frontiers the merciless Indian savages, whose only known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. So the I just say that because that's the people probably realize that's the Declaration of Independence, which a lot of people point to when we talk about our rights in this country, right, or rights that exist for folks in this country. We point to the Declaration of Independence, and we point to the Constitution of the United States of America, which are both demonstrably and unarguably explicitly racist documents, right? The Constitution explicitly says that black people have count for 3/5 of a human being, but not in terms of rights. That's for, you know, proportional representation. And it also explicitly talks about how much, and I'll actually do this as a question. Do people know what it says in the second half of that sentence about what Native people count for in terms of proportional representation? 0/5. So black folks counted for 3/5, Native folks counted for nothing, actually. And actually, those words, you actually, if you amend the Constitution, you don't take words out, you actually just add words. So those words still exist in the Constitution, I say of this country, I don't say of our country, but of that exist, because I learned that from Malcolm X, but of this country, those words still exist. You can go, you know, downtown Boston, and those words are carved in stone, you know, in the lobbies of some buildings. I used to work in the John Hancock building, and it had the merciless Indian savages quote. It has that in the wall where I used to work, right? Exactly, right? So I think those are some things that we need to think about. And I think some of the language in terms of this panel talked about joining of movements and having solidarity across movements, which I explicitly disagree with, right? Explicitly. But I disagree with it sort of in solidarity. I think, if that makes any sense, it probably doesn't. But I think what we're really talking about is a movement that has one specific goal. And that goal, and folks have said, that goal is liberation, right? That goal is freedom. And if people know the Dream Defenders, an organization in Miami and kind of spreading nationally across the country, Umi Sela, who's a really visionary person and probably one of the best public speakers I've ever heard, they have a series of kind of revolutionary T-shirts, and one of their T-shirts says, I've been to the future. We won. Right? And that's a lot, right? I'll say it again, because some people say, it says, I've been to the future. We won. And that, I think, speaks to that goal of freedom, right? So to me, it is a battle, it is a struggle for liberation that takes place in different ways, in different arenas, whether that's spray painting graffiti on the wall in Palestine or spray painting graffiti on both sides of the wall in Mexico and in the United States, whether that's, you know, people protesting here in Boston or, you know, or in Puerto Rico. But we're fighting for systems that have been created at the foundational structures of these countries, of the United States and of Israel. That's, to me, Zionism and systems of white supremacy are two sides of the same coin, right? They're structures that were built to oppress people, to steal land, to steal resources, and create false senses of superiority. The system of white supremacy that was invented, whiteness was created in the United States for the United States, to build wealth upon the backs primarily of people of African descent, of black people, right? Whiteness was created for that purpose. It exists for that purpose. And it arguably, that means I want to argue with you about it if you don't agree, it arguably is the single most deadly thing that has ever been created in the history of humanity, right? Nuclear weapons have not killed as many people. Even nuclear power has not killed as many people. Like, natural disasters haven't killed as many people. That structure saying, you are less than me, therefore we can kill you, we can burn you in ovens, we can steal your land, we can bomb you with napalm until, you know, a tenth of your population no longer exists. Those things become either possible or more possible because of the system of white supremacy that was invented for the structure of chattel slavery in the United States of America. And when we talk about it, just as when we talk about the structure of the occupation, theft of land, and the stealing of human rights of Palestinian and other Arab people, we need to talk about Zionism, or you cannot have that conversation. You cannot have that conversation without talking about Zionism. When we have the conversation about the United States and its the neocolonial and imperial construct around the world, we cannot have that conversation unless at the root of it we're talking about white supremacy. I'll actually just say, because it's really inspirational for me, have people seen this video that black activists in the United States and Palestinian activists created? It's called When I See Them, I See Us. People, if you haven't seen that, see it, take a look at it. I would show it now. We don't have a lot of time, though. You should take a look at it. If you've seen it before, see it again. I just watched it again, and it really touched me. But organizations are doing that. Dream Defenders, actually, and Black Lives Matter took a delegation of folks, in addition to, you know, the delegations that Gabe was talking about, took delegations of black folks and, you know, Afro-Caribbean folks to Palestine. And people had an immediate sense of solidarity. They had a sense of solidarity before, but immediately sense a connection with the land, an immediate sense of solidarity with the struggles that were happening there and the struggles that were happening in their homes across the United States. But I think, just as an introduction, I just wanted to really say that really when I think of these struggles, I think of it as one struggle. If there are, you know, victories in terms of, you know, what is happening in terms of, let's say, the BDS struggle, and I actually just want to say one brief thing about the BDS struggle and what sounds like 24, 25 states passing legislation criminalizing BDS actions in the United States. You think that's kind of bad, right? That sucks, right? It is actually, I'm going to make you think of that as a good thing, right? And I'm going to say it real frank, because I disdain respectability politics. They are afraid of us. Yeah. I play chess a lot, and when you do a really good move and the other side is kind of fucked, this is what someone does. They're like, all right, I need to do something really drastic at this point. I'm going to do something really drastic. And then they do the drastic thing, and you're like, you weren't thinking when you did that. That is them responding to us. That is them losing, right? So now we're at the point I said, look, there's the structure of the Israeli state. There are activists and organizers, Palestinian-led, taking up the BDS struggle. There's us, that structure of people winning a lot of victories in that and clearly changing the dynamic of the discussion. And then they pass anti-BDS legislation, right, which should on its face appear unconstitutional. But if you're hoping for it to be unconstitutional in the court, I'll disabuse you of that notion. Just, you know, look on your phone at a picture of the United States Supreme Court. If you're investing your belief of liberation and freedom in this struggle on those people, look at a picture. And I, you know, footnote to white supremacy. If you think a bunch of people in black robes whose mind, even if they're a little bit more brown or even if they're a little bit more gendered as women, and you think they're going to save you, and also the direction that it's going, it's, you know, centrist at best, diving towards the deep, deep, horrifying right. So I think that they are not going to save us. We are going to save us, right? So I just wanted to say that about BDS. We are winning. That is plays of desperation and said by people long before me. Organized people will beat organized money every single time. And one of the things I think we need to do really is dare to dream, do things in more dramatic ways, confront power in real ways, and understand that our liberation is our responsibility, and all of us are complicit in oppression in ways, and you know, and there's a good thing about that, because then we can actually take responsibility, right? None of our state legislators, our federal legislators, the president, those people are not going to be part of this liberation, but we can force them to do less and sometimes hide it and actually once in a while do something positive. If we believe that, if we take dramatic action, we can make more people be free, and we can be an example of freedom for other folks. Thanks.
I am humbled and honored to follow the three of you and to be here with Jamila. All of you are my teachers, and I have learned so much from you today, but also in other spaces, and I'm want to take just an opportunity to thank you all for your work, for being visionaries, for being folks who also pass batons and who are willing and eager for others to take up the struggle, to learn lessons and to be better and to be stronger. I am better because of you, and I'm so thankful to be here. I've spent the last 7 years of my life, my name is Nadia Ben Youssef, and I work with the Adala Justice Project, a sister organization of Adala, the Legal Center for Arab Minority Rights in Israel, where I've spent the last 7 years and the first years of my human rights career and my legal career, learning from also freedom fighters and alongside Palestinians who have a vision for justice that has inspired me beyond measure. But those 7 years have also landed me often face to face with the anxiety of the state of Israel, face to face with them in interrogation rooms. And so I tell this story as a way to build upon what my colleagues and comrades have said. I'll take you to March of this year. And this has happened every time in the last 7 years that I've been able, and it's a privilege, to enter Israel, to work with Adala. But my last name is Bin Youssef, said with a U and not an O, and that becomes quite important when someone says, how do you pronounce your last name? Because Yosef is something, and Youssef is something else. I learned this only in Israel, actually. And so I answer the question, Youssef, and they say, come with us. So Youssefs go to the Arab room, as those of us who've been there and have a Youssef in our name understand, and another Arab or Muslim names, or have darker skin, or are perceived in some way as a threat to the status quo. So they say, come with us, and so you're in the Arab room. I've been there for the last 7 years. And what's interesting about this position is what I learn about the empire, what I learn about Israel in those spaces of interrogation. So I was there in March of this year, 2017, and I had an interrogator named Jason. And there's always a moment when the interrogation turns. After kind of the niceties of where are you from, what are you doing, what's Adala, something happens and there's a shift. You feel the air tighten around you, the temperature drops. And so in the past, starting in, say, 2010, when I was entering the country in 2010, the interrogation turned on this question. Who do you know that's organizing direct action? Are you connected with ISM, the International Solidarity Movement? Who's leading the protests in the Nakab? Who do you know in the West Bank that's organizing direct action? Who's leading those Friday protests? Who is on the ground doing that work? That's when the intensity would increase, starting in 2010. Then we're having a wave of discriminatory legislation that's passing in Israel starting in 2011. One of those was the anti-boycott law that was passed in 2011, upheld by the Israeli Supreme Court in 2015. Adala worked on this case, challenged the BDS law of Israel, and that became an obsession for the state. The state was obsessed with BDS, who I knew, what was going on, what was Adala's interest in this, what was our legal arguments, who in the United States is organizing on BDS, am I a part of the BDS movement, am I calling for boycott of Israel, do I believe in sanctions, what do you mean by divestment? The interrogation would turn on BDS. And that was that. Really, it took us a long time. And Adala's answer, because Adala, as a Palestinian organization based in Israel, because of this law, has a prohibition on it with regard to the call for BDS. So the law says that if you call for boycott, it had created a new civil wrong. You can be sued in court if you call for a boycott of Israel. So Adala has pivoted its argument about BDS to say we are for the right to boycott. That has been my answer in interrogation. That is my answer in public forum. We support the right to boycott. And Israel, and as I understand through interrogation, has become okay with that, actually. So Jason, we're in March 2017. Why is your name Jason? I don't know. But Jason says, so tell me about BDS. This is actually part of the niceties. The interrogation didn't turn. Tell me about BDS. And I said, well, Adala supports the right to boycott. There is a right to boycott, freedom of expression. We believe in it wholeheartedly. We also believe in the pillars of the BDS movement. And I went as far as I could. And Jason said, okay. And then Jason turned away from his computer, closed his book, and looked at me and said, tell me about intersectionality. Like this. And I mean, I couldn't help it. Like, a smile erupted in my face. And I said, that's the interrogation question. And I said, well, amazingly, it's started by black feminists. It's an idea that our oppressions are interlocked. And it was actually coined by a legal scholar named Kimberly Crenshaw. He said, Nadia, that's not what I mean. You know that's not what I mean. He said, what are you doing to connect struggles that have nothing to do with each other? You're creating confusion. You're creating chaos. We as the government are completely opposed to these efforts to build solidarity and a cross-movement struggle. And I said, we are winning. In my head. I said, we are winning, to Carl's point. When you see the empire tremble, that's where you know where to push. That is where you know where to push. That is what scares the state. When it looks out and sees groups of people connected, yes, of course, by their oppression, understanding that their oppressions are linked, but who are joining forces because they believe, even more so, that their liberations are tied. That is when the system is dismantled, and that is when we win. And so when we look at our advocacy strategies moving forward, I encourage you in your own life, certainly, but as community organizers, as activists, as artists, as teachers, as human rights defenders, as politicians, as nurses, think about this. This is when we win. And I would say a few things just about what we can learn from intersectionality so that we can continue moving this conversation forward. But really, all that I wanted to say has been said. Intersectionality, actually, in the way that Jason understood it, in the way that we've talked about it as well, I mean, it has kind of two different ideas. One is kind of a popular understanding of intersectionality, which we actually are thinking about as joint struggle. When Jason said intersectionality, he was thinking less about the black feminist thought from which it comes, the academic idea of intersectionality. And he was thinking more about cross-movement building and the idea that this is one struggle. That's what he was thinking about. And in fact, it's interesting that those terms have been conflated because we can learn a lot from the analysis of intersectionality within our movements. And in fact, our joint struggle or our one struggle is strengthened, is protected from fragmentation, actually can win when we have an intersectional analysis, when we center the experiences of those most impacted by oppression, when we center Native history and Native visions of liberation, then you start understanding exactly what world we're trying to create. So I think, and actually Giacomo, I don't know if you're still here, but Giacomo asked a great question when he was looking at the Arab Spring. And he asked, you know, how can we make sure that we're not replicating systems of oppression in our movements, in our liberation, in our freedom? And that is the intersectional analysis. And of course, a young person is bringing that up as his question and saying, that's what I'm concerned about. How do I know that everyone will get free and not just those who are buying into neocolonial models, as you said, Giacomo, those who are benefiting from systems of economic systems, neoliberal models. So they're asking us really to think differently about what liberation looks like. So centering the most impacted is a critical conversation that comes from intersectionality and should be the way that we organize our movements. Intersectionality also tells us something about how trauma can coexist with privilege. Intersectionality demands that of us. Where, as Carl said, are we complicit in systems of oppression? What do we need to relinquish about our own power and our own privilege in order for all of us to be liberated? And I think that becomes really important, and it becomes important with the story of Israel as well. Trauma can coexist with power and privilege. That's what intersectionality tells us. And I want to move a little bit to just kind of my own analysis how it has shifted my understanding of my work in the United States. So Adela, 3 years ago, said, go to the U.S., map the movement, see where we should intervene, what does it look like to build a mass movement for Palestinian rights, and to kind of shift American discourse and ultimately policy. And so initially I was doing kind of, well, where are we actually working now? And was seeing at the time in 2013, you know, a lot of focus on convincing the oppressor. Convincing the oppressor, demanding that those in power recognize the humanity of those who of whom they've stripped that power, recognize our humanity. And that was our target as a movement. We were saying, please, like, and we were going like this. We were lifting up, going to those with the power. What has happened over time, and you know, we spoke about it, and Yusuf mentioned it in the summer of 2014, and how our movement has shifted, is suddenly we said, we're going to stop doing that. The power is actually when we do this. This is where the power is. And what we're doing is not advocating to those with power to relinquish a bit of power, because it's creating an alternative nexus of power. An alternative nexus of power. Say that again.
No, sorry. I said the one we want.
That's the one we want. That's the one we want. No, it's totally right. Build like this. See in your life where you are building like this and reaching and asking, and build like this, where the power is real. And so in that, our advocacy strategy kind of shifted. And what we said is we need to de-exceptionalize Israel-Palestine in American discourse. De-exceptionalize Israel-Palestine. This is not a unique issue that history has nothing to say about, that we have no progressive or no value system that can really absorb what's happening in Israel-Palestine. In fact, we do. You have all the tools at your disposal. So on one hand, I love and I'm grateful, and I took 18 pages of notes from the scholars and researchers who led us and grounded our discussion today. But oftentimes, complexity is also a tool of empire. Complexity is a tool of empire. It makes us think, I can never know that much. I can never study that much. I didn't write a book. I don't have a PhD. I'm not Jewish. I'm not Palestinian. How in the world can I have an opinion on this issue? And I say you have an opinion because you are a human being and you understand the value of what that means. And so we need to de-exceptionalize Israel-Palestine, demystify. This is not complicated. It might be difficult, in that it is always difficult to wrest power from those who have stolen it. That's difficult. That's not complicated. And then on the last point, I will say, just for us to start thinking, and as we're moving into the workshops and we're building advocacy strategies, we're starting to understand exactly what our role is now in this moment, which is different. It's different, and it's better, because we can learn from history. Certainly, joint struggle is not a new idea. It's not a new idea. Our elders have been engaged in this since the beginning of struggle, recognizing that our liberation is tied. But with this intersectional analysis, we have something better. We have something better, and we have a protection from the fragmentation, from the discord that is generated when certain people within movements have more power than others. So we have a tool. And I would just say, this might be also kind of moving away from respectability, which is the way we should go for sure, but we've talked a lot about PEPs in our movement. PEPs, which are progressive on everything but Palestine. PEPs, okay? So we thought, okay, this is the problematic thing. We have to show them that they're actually not progressive. We have to try to align their progressive values with the liberation of Palestine. And I would say, okay, so that's an issue, certainly. PEPs are an issue. But more problematic to me now, and I hope to us in the future and moving forward, are what we call POOPs. And POOPs are progressive only on Palestine. Progressive only on Palestine. And to those, I say, there's the door. If you are here because you believe that Palestinians alone deserve liberation, you are not part of this movement. If you are here because you believe that Palestinians should be free at the expense of others, you are not part of this movement. If you are homophobic, you are not part of this movement. If you are supporting institutions and ideologies of white supremacy, you are not part of this movement. You are part of this movement if you stand for native liberation. You are part of this movement if you stand for black power. You are part of this movement if you are here because this is a global struggle for justice, that we are part of a community that struggles for justice, and that is why you are here. If there's any other reason, there's the door. This movement is huge. We are numerous, but we are numerous when we realize that we are interconnected, that our struggles are tied, and that our liberation is only ours when we are there together. Thank you.
Yeah. You have been listening to Matoi Monroe, Gabriel Camacho, Carl Williams, and Nadia Ben Youssef, who comprise the powerful intersectionality panel of the Balfour Legacy Conference held in Cambridge, Massachusetts on November 11th, 2017. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.